short on the WWP line, and then you could talk to your parents. I don't know how accurate that is, but that's how he perceived long distance service to be. And that was probably the early, very early days. So
they have phone lines that put up along the edge of the lake?
They ran into the Washington Water Power line. That was how they got long distance service out. And there was a Washington Water Power line. That was one of the first things that would be put in when they were putting in the mine. There was a line that ran across the lake. And actually, Linda Jensen is working on information on how many people died in the mining years. And what I found was that there were really, as far as a percentage of accidents, there were more people killed during the installation of that line. And those were Washington Water Power employees, as opposed to people who died here. In the time frame, there were more people in a shorter time frame who were injured or killed then. One of the things I found really interesting was they had dance bands. They had their own dance bands, and they had dance bands imported for the big parties. And that was typical of other small towns. When Grand Coulee Dion was finished, they brought in dance bands from places like Pullman, because I'm sure it's WSU affiliated, to celebrate the completion of the dam. And they had casual and formal dances, and they had a wide variety of other social events. The formal dances, the woman who does the Holden Miner told me about how her mother had the equivalent of tire chains that she put on her galoshes when she was walking in the village. And I said, but how did she get to a dance? This family lived in a circle, so they didn't have that far to go. But she said, oh, you just put your formal gown, you just put the hem over your arm, and you put the galoshes on over your dancing shoes, and you walk down there, and that's how you did it. The people who lived in what is now Chalet 13 came in the late 40s, and they learned to square dance from records. They had a square dancing club, and I said, but who called? And Mrs. Wilbur said, well, the calls were right there on the records, so you just had to pay attention. So there were all sorts of things like that that went on. They had lots of clubs. If you talk to Linda Jensen, she'll tell you all about the birthday clubs and the card clubs and the sewing clubs. And they had things for kids. They had campfire, they had Boy Scouts, they had Bluebirds, they had Cub Scouts. They had sewing clubs for the kids. The man who ran the grocery store for a while said it was really, the evenings were full. He said there was lots going on in the evenings. They also did fundraising. There were hospital leagues. And one year they raised $600 for the Chelan Hospital, and they raised another $600 for Children's Orthopedic, which in the early 50s, to me, sounds like a lot of money. They had sports teams and sports leagues. I was told that by one person in his era, they often had four softball teams organized by department, and they had lots of bowling leagues. And I think they had visiting bowling leagues come in. There's a picture in my book of a bowling tournament, and we circulated this picture to almost everyone we could think of, and no one could identify any of the women who were actually bowling, but they could identify all of the people who were sitting waiting on the same seats that you have in the bowling alley today. And finally, we decided this was a team from outside that had come in, and that was why we couldn't identify any of the people who were actually bowling. They had a ritual called waiting for the mail when the noon bus came up from Lucerne, which brought not only the people, but brought the mail. And that was very characteristic of similar towns that I studied. But I got to thinking about what life was like. I grew up in the community near Pacific Lutheran University, and we got mail twice a day when I was a young girl. And in the Christmas season, we got mail three times a day. Wow. And in fact, I think when I went to work, we were still getting mail twice a day in the cities. You had a morning mail and an afternoon mail. So I don't think waiting for the mail was all that unusual in towns of that era. And speaking of trends, despite the weather and despite the location, people dressed pretty much like people in more metropolitan areas. Now, what impressed me as I interviewed the people and researched the community were several things. Probably the most notable was that people came here and they stayed. Some people were here the entire 20 years that the community operated. And I think that was because remote locations were very typical for mining families, that when if you married a minor, you knew this is what was going to happen. And some of the people told me that Holden was the nicest mining camp they ever lived in. So I think people came here and were happy to stay, not only because of the Depression, but because it was such a nice facility. John Bly, who some of you may know, was an outstanding football player at WSC in the 30s, came here straight out of college. And when I interviewed him, he said, I told my girlfriend that if she kept hanging around with me, she'd end up in a tar paper shack, and darned if she didn't, because they got married, and he refurbished an old cabin at the Honeymoon Heights, and it was tar paper when they moved in. They were here until 1952, raised their children here. Another reason that people stayed was this was a very comfortable place during the Depression. It was, your housing was, for the management, top management, housing was free. It was very modestly priced for everyone else. A lot of people hunted, so their expenditures on groceries were pretty limited. You didn't have to have a car, and many people in the beginning did not have cars. So it was possible to save money, and a lot of people did. And another thing was during World War II, the men could get deferments because they were involved in copper mining. So that was, there were people who came here just because it was a way to stay out of the military. As I've said about fashion, people expected to live like their friends and their family elsewhere. There were people who moved in, especially the people who were relocated by Howe Sound Mining Company, who came down from Premier and Britannia Beach, British Columbia. They moved in with their silver tea sets and their bone china, and several of them barged pianos down Howe Sound, down the coast, the Pacific coast, and then up Lake Chelan. So then there were a lot of people who arrived with nothing. I interviewed one woman whose father was a carpenter and came in the very beginning, and they had like a panel delivery truck with a mattress and box spring in the back, and that's what they slept on coming across country with their two little girls, and they came up Lake. And she said she and her sister slept on that box spring mattress the entire 3 years they were here. And her parents ordered a fold-out couch from Sears Roebuck. And he built a table that was attached to the wall of the kitchen and two benches. And they, I think the house had a stove when they moved in. But that's all they had. Someone sent them a lamp as a thank you gift. And I think she said they had one extra chair. And then they left when the war came because her father went to Alaska to work in some defense industry. But she said that was all they ever had in the house. So it was very Spartan for some people. They set up a movie projector and they showed movies here 3 times a week. They organized children's Christmas parties and Easter cantatas, and they brought in these big city bands and the big city fashion. One of the things they did as a fundraiser was have a fashion show, and I found in the old Holden Miners a record of when Eddie's Flying Service flew in the models, flew in the fashions, wow, flew in the jewelry, and flew in the flowers from Chelan. In the little newspaper story, there's a credit of everybody who provided materials for this fundraising fashion show. So they had events like that. The kids had Tony Permanence, the kids had braces, they had the scout and campfire activities. Linda Jensen was talking about how they went out to campfire, council fire once a year. And I think it was Florence Field, who was principal here for 19 years. She took the girls who were graduating from the 8th grade out on their senior sneak for 3 days down lake 1 year. So they had activities similar to that. I think basically whatever they wanted and could afford, they got. They ordered it from Sears Roebuck, they ordered it from Frederick and Nelson, or they ordered it from the Chelan merchants who would put it on the boat, they'd take it to the dock, and it would be barged up. If you read the old Holden Miners, you will find that they were advertising everything from records to drugs, really legitimate drugs, to skis, to coal and floor furnaces, and they said quick delivery. So those things were coming up. One of the fascinating stories I thought was women would trace their feet and send the tracing to Frederick and Nelson, and they would send shoes in. But you know, that is really not so different. When I grew up in Tacoma, we did not have a Frederick and Nelson store, and we did not have a Nordstrom. And people would call up Frederick and Nelson, and they would send things down UPS for approval. And if you didn't like it or it didn't fit, you sent it back. So again, it was still very typical of the era. Some people went out a few times a year to shop, and some of the people I interviewed said they remembered things like getting on the escalators at either the Crescent in Spokane or Frederick and Nelson in Seattle, and the kids had almost never been on escalators. So that's what the kids did. They ran up and down the escalators while their parents were shopping. But going out was a major excursion. When we came here the first time, our younger child, who was sitting here, was six. And we were past diapers. There's people here with diapers and porta-cribs, and you weren't doing that. But I really became aware of what a project this was for any family that wanted to go out. Honeymoon Heights was settled by young professionals and their brides, but obviously very early on there were children in that community, and those people came down to the village for mail or for any little shopping that they did at the company commissary, or for any social events, and they came down that trail. If you've been to the museum or you've been up to Honeymoon Heights, you know what that trail is like. They came down that trail dressed up. If they were going out, they were dressed up, and they were walking or carrying children. There was no way to come down in a vehicle from Honeymoon Heights. And so they had that trail to come down, and then you got down here, and you took the bus down to the dock, or if you were coming from Winston, you walked here, and you caught the bus, and you went down. And what you have to remember is it operated just like the fast boat does today. You would go down because the bus met the uplake boat, and you would have to sit there on the dock and wait for the downlake boat. And even in the 50s, this was quite a project. When I was interviewing Harriet Wilbur, who lived in what is now Chalet 13, she had three small children, and she said it was exhausting. You got down there dressed up, and you had three small children that you had to keep out of the water and clean while you were waiting the hour or two for the next boat to come. She has quite a sense of humor, and she says, consequently, the Wilbers almost never went out. If you were going to go out by car, if after the war, when a lot of people had cars, you either kept your car in Chelan in a garage, or maybe you kept it at Lucerne, but the car had to be loaded on one of the ore barges. And so you drove your car onto a pallet-like platform, and they hoisted it on the top of those giant canisters that carried the ore out, and then the company took it out for free. And there is a picture in the book, and I understand there's a picture in the museum of the cars on the ore canisters. So, and Linda Jensen was telling me that her father had invested in Eddie's Flying Service when it was set up after the war, and so her father was able to fly home on the weekends when they were waiting for a house to become available at Chelan. Her family lived in Chelan when they were waiting. And there were other people I interviewed who said that they too would fly home, especially the management children who maybe were at boarding school. Occasionally they got to fly home rather than go through this real involved project. And I have a picture here that came out of National Geographic, and you can see it. You can see this was a yellow school bus style vehicle that was on the dock. I'll have this if you want to see it later. And once you got to Chelan, you would catch a bus to Wenatchee to catch a train, especially in the early years. And due to the schedules, you usually had to stay overnight in Chelan, both coming and going. You couldn't take the boat to Chelan, spend a few hours shopping or going to a movie or anything like that, and catch the next boat home, because there was no next boat. Despite this, there were people who did go out regularly. After the war, there was a blinded miner who set up a store where we have the bookstore today, and he and his wife and daughter went out regularly. They went out whenever their daughter was having her braces worked on, and he and his wife used those as buying trips for the store. They probably went out the most frequently of anybody that I talked to. Some people did go to Seattle to shop and visit relatives, and of course the high school and college kids went out to school. And that brings me to the topic of school, which is an aspect of life that seems unusual until you consider the era again. Kids who lived in Holden either had to use correspondence courses or move away after the eighth grade. many families considered this unacceptable. There were families, like the storekeeper's family, where they said to their daughter, when you go to high school, we will leave. And the same thing with the Wilbers. That was the deadline they set, was that when their oldest child went to high school, they would not stay. But it was not unusual, and it was particularly not unusual in the other company towns that I looked at, that kids were sent away to go to high school. Even if they had a very small high school in their community, they might have been sent away for a better education. So what some families did was a forerunner of the commuter marriage. Sometimes, in Nigel Adams' case, his mother moved the two of them to Spokane. She took a job. They took an apartment. He went to Gonzaga Prep, and they came home for the extended vacations at Christmas and spring and for summer, and that was it. And then after 2 years, they did something that was more typical. They sent him to Chelan to board with a family and attend Chelan High School. And then when their daughter reached high school age, they sent her to Kirkland to live with an aunt, which was also very typical of that era. There were wives that went out for their own education. Florence Field, whose family actually lived at Fields Point. They had an orchard there, and so her husband spent a lot of time at the orchard, and she spent time there in the summer. But she went every summer to teacher training programs. And Harriet Wilbur, when she decided to get emergency certification so that she could teach here in the 50s, she took those three small children and moved to Bellingham for the summer to get her certification. She did this with their winnings from the Irish sweepstakes.
Really?
Apparently there was someone in the village who sold tickets, and she said it was not quite legal. But they won, he got a cut, and they got, I think she said $2,000 or $3,000 for that
money,
obviously, for her summer in Bellingham. Many families sent their kids out by themselves. To me, it's very hard to imagine putting a 14-year-old on the train or the bus across state, but a lot of the kids did that. Bill Phillips, whose family was here, his parents were here for the first 19 years of their marriage, and they lived probably in more different locations than any other family. He was the older child, and when he was 14, they took him to Seattle and enrolled him at Lakeside, and he had grandparents and an aunt, so he had people to go to occasionally. But he would take an overnight bus from Seattle to Wenatchee. He would arrive in the morning, and then they changed buses in those days. He would come to Chelan, and he would just manage to make the boat up. And I talked to Marge and Patty Haddon, their father was management. They lived in one of the first chalets. They would come home from Forest Ridge in Seattle. Very similar situation. It's just hard to imagine turning a 14-year-old loose in a public transportation system, but it's very typical in that area. Some of the kids didn't find it very comfortable, especially those kids who've been isolated here. Marge Haddon, who was high school age when they came here, said that they stayed at Campbell's Lodge. I think that was probably the only place to stay. And she said the Campbell boys would set off the fire alarm in an attempt to get her to come out of her room in her slip. Girls talked. She and John Curzon's daughter talked about they would go in their room at Campbell's and not come out because they were afraid to be alone. And I have a quote here from Duran Curzon said that Mrs. Campbell would watch after, look out for them when they were alone. But she said she would not leave her room otherwise. And what was also interesting to talk to these girls, and Bill Phillips too, was that some of them were homesick and some of them were very uncomfortable. They had been isolated here, and they went to big city schools where they really felt they were being disdained as hicks. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the kids who went from here to expensive boarding schools were management kids, and so they had a certain position in this community. And they got out, and Patty Haddon Tappan said she had to wear these long cotton socks, and everybody else was wearing nylons, and they were fashionable, and she just felt like a real hick. And these girls said it was very hard to deal with the girls who had cashmere twin sets. And schools like Annie Wright and Forest Ridge, and they also missed going to real schools because they were in uniforms and they didn't have proms and things like that.
Campbell Lodge that you were talking about?
It's the same Campbell's Lodge that exists in Chelan today.
It's in Chelan.
One of the questions I asked almost everybody who lived in a company-owned town was, how did you handle grocery shopping? And what happened here was not atypical of what happened in some other remote communities. In Holden, in the pre-war era, all they had was a commissary, and it was located where the laundry is today. And so when you came to Holden, one of the first things you did was go to Chelan and open up a grocery account, unless you were going to shop at Safeway, in which case you had to send a check down every week with your grocery order. And if you sent out a check, then when your box came back up, there would be an envelope with your change in the box of groceries. The groceries were delivered by the grocers to the dock, and then they were barged up by the company. They were laid out on the dock in the order that your house was. And then they were loaded in the truck and trucked up here by the company, and then the company delivered the groceries to each house. And if you lived at Honeymoon Heights, your groceries had to go up in what was called the skip, which was a steel box. John Bly said it was 7 or 8 feet long by 2 feet wide, and I'm assuming it was several feet deep. And every so often, if it was run too fast, the box would jump off the cable. And Mrs. Bly, when she was taped, was recalling how one time it was coming up and it came off, and the groceries all went over the valley, and there was all this white bread that was flying out. And during the war, this is something I found fascinating. During the war, you sent your ration book down with your order, which seems incredibly trusting of people. And Mrs. Bly also said that you might have filled out an order, but if they didn't have what you were ordering, they just substituted. She said you always got something. You just don't. And that was typical. I interviewed the people who lived at Cedar Falls, which is the Seattle City Light Tunnel off I-90, and their groceries came from North End, and that was very typical there, too. So, after the war, part of Building 6 was converted to a grocery store, and it was run as a concession, first by the Price Cash Store, which had branches in Chelan and Manson, and then later by the Peter Rabbit grocery chain. The groceries came in once a week, and some of the merchandise, of course, was not fresh by the end of the week. And one of the people I interviewed said that there was a certain time when the manager was working hard to improve the bottom line, and he refused to put out new stock until the old stock was sold. Mm-hmm. And so there was actually a period where you had to make sure the meat wasn't moldy and the fuzz wasn't wilted. Mm-hmm. If you wanted something that the store did not ordinarily carry, you could request it, and it would eventually come, maybe not the next week, but the week after, it would come out of the warehouse in Chelan, or it would be special ordered in from some other part of the state. And that also is not all that atypical. I mean, my first job was in Davenport, and I needed almond paste for some recipe, and they did not carry that in Davenport in the early 70s, and I had to have it brought in from Spokane. I had to order it a few days in advance. So again, it wasn't unusual. A lot of families continued to order from Chelan even after the store was here, in part because they were more comfortable with the quality of the merchandise, and there was a lot of baking and canning. During the war, of course, there was meat rationing, and so people continued to can venison, and part of the reason they canned was a lot of people didn't have freezers in those days. Of course, you couldn't get a freezer during the war. Then there was a lot of canning of fruit. One of the other wartime stories that I thought was very interesting is some people were still using gas-powered washing machines, even though there was electricity to all the homes down here. There was not necessarily electricity up in Honeymoon Heights. But people got together to wash because gas was rationed. As far as other shopping, there was the general store run by Fred Rippers, the blinded miner, where the bookstore is today. And he had guns, ammunition, fishing tackle, fishing licenses, appliances. At Christmas, he had toys. I think they had some basic dishes. The postmaster shared the space, and he sold the magazine subscriptions because he had to fill in the blanks. Who knows? Then after the store was opened and they closed the commissary, A woman named Helen Bell opened a dress shop in that space where the laundromat is today. And she carried things like Avon and anklets and women's slacks, children's clothing. And it was she who did things like arrange the fashion show from Chelan as a fundraiser. And then there were other little home businesses. There were people who repaired shoes on their off hours. And the postmaster's wife sold gift items like china and candlesticks from her home. So there were some opportunities for buying things. Most of the people that I interviewed mentioned the snow. They didn't mention heat. They didn't talk about weather like last week. But they talked about the snow. One year in the 50s, the town was written up in Life magazine because it had more than 50 feet of snow over the course of the year. Not a model. But that was double the usual amount. So I guess they figured that they would ordinarily have 25 feet of snow during the year. And because of the snow, the cars were taken to Lucerne or Chelan for the winter, so they were out of the way of snow plows, and so they were safe from an overload of snow. I have a couple of pictures that Harriet Wilbur sent me of Chalet 13. This is the back door of Chalet 13. And again, I'll have this later if you want to see it. This is about the winter of 1955-56 in February. And this was the front of the house. The Life magazine feature shows tunnels. They're basically open-top tunnels that people went through because the snow was piled so high. And there are anecdotes about men who shoveled snow 24 hours a day. And there were different shifts, and that's all they did was shovel snow to keep the road clear and keep the mine port open. Because of the snow, once groceries were being sold here, the grocer had a sled for delivering groceries to Winston. Which is, if you've done the Winston walk, that's kind of interesting to imagine hauling groceries all that way. And Linda Jensen mentioned something that many other people mentioned, and that was the laundry lines were all strung from the second story of the house, either from a high porch or out a high window. And one woman told me that she was here for a reunion, and someone turned around at Vespers and said, "Were you the girl who fell out the window?" And she said, indeed, she had fallen out the window, and she landed on a sheet of plywood or something like that that was being used in a construction project down below, so she wasn't injured. The avalanches were a danger both on the hills between the village and Winston and between the village and Lucerne. There are lots and lots of comments about people who came up in the bus from Lucerne and they got to a snowslide and they got out and they walked over the snowslide and then somebody came down from Holden and picked them up on the other side of the snowslide. Or that's how the mail bag, somebody would even maybe hike down to pick up the mail bag from the bus because they were anxious. So that was very typical. And again, Harriet Wilbur, who lived up in Chalet 13, tells about the time her preschooler came in covered with snow, and she said, "What have you been doing?" And he said, "Well, the snow just came down the hill." So there's apparently a small avalanche field just above Chalet 13. The snow was so deep that many of the houses had very little light most of the winter. When we were here 4 years ago, I was able to go into the chalet that was in the top of the circle, and the people who were living there as long-term staff pointed out to me how high the snow came in the winter. And in their dining room, you could hardly see out because there was so much accumulated snow. And that is the highest house here in the village. At Honeymoon Heights, the Blythes talked about how they had to slide in their living room from the outdoors when winter came. Because of the way the snow fell, apparently somebody opened the door and the person who was outside just slid down again. Now, I would like to remind you that these people did not have indoor plumbing, and so they got to slide in their 90s, and they made the last walk to the outhouse at night. One of the characteristic of company towns that was, and it was common here, was that the company subsidized a lot of the expenses. One of the things that happened here was that wood for fuel was provided free. The Forest Service would mark the trees, the trees would be assigned to families, and then men would go out often in teams and cut down and split the wood, stack it by the side of the road, and then the company would truck the wood to the respective homes. Mrs. Wilbur has a story about someone who never cut his own wood. He just borrowed from different piles all year long. Room and board was very modest in price. When miners were making between $155 and $248 a month, they were paying $1.20 a day for room and board. And I didn't read anything about the meals, and the meals were very generous. In a company town, there was never any limit on how much you ate. And I think I calculated that miners were eating about a pound and a quarter of meat a day.
Wow.
Between how much bacon they had. I figured out, based on how many miners there were and how much bacon they were bringing in and how much beef they were bringing in, that that's what they were eating. And later they were paying $1.80 for a board and room in a time when they were making as much as $8.50 a day. Mm-hmm. So still. The housing in the circle was free for the top managers, and the people who lived at the top of the circle paid $21 a month in the 50s. And I don't know what they paid before, but probably more modest. In Winston, the company financed the construction of many of the houses, and they set the price for the land leases, and they set the price. I think you paid one penny per kilowatt for power. The interesting thing here was the company also controlled the sales price of your house. They refused to allow real estate speculation, and so what they did was allow you to sell your house for no more than you had paid for it plus the cost of any improvements that you had made. So you did have to keep track of what you were putting in your house. And this company subsidized remodeling in ways that they probably didn't intend to. There's a story about a man who filched dynamite from the blasting cupboard, took it home because he was tired of digging out his basement, his blast out his wife was canning jam upstairs, and so when something went wrong, apparently everything exploded in the kitchen. I guess the comment was that the company didn't say much because they figured his wife had taken care of him. The houses in the circle were assigned by positions, so if you got promoted, you moved. And for example, Bill Phillips' family moved. They lived in two different houses in the circle because of the promotion. So, the recreation hall was built by the company, and some of the expenses were covered by the Recreation Association dues, which is also very typical in company towns. Any record of company towns usually talks about what people paid. In 1948, here they were paying 75 cents a month for Recreation Association fees. And that paid for things like the sports equipment and the magazine subscriptions and I suppose things like folding chairs and just general maintenance. But the company did provide the building. And there was also some money for the Recreation Association that came from the movie concession. There was a family called Rogers, which operated the movie concession almost the entire 20 years. First the parents, and then one of their children and her husband. And they had to pay 10% of their gross to the community organization. So that was how there was some funding there. The newspaper was printed on the company mimeograph, and there was a payroll category for making donations. It might have been a donation to March of Dimes, or it might have been a donation to the recently bereaved families. Linda Jensen has a story about when her father had a heart attack and died, and the miners, his co-workers, signed up to contribute certain amounts to the family, and she told me that that is really what paid for her family's trip outside for the funeral. And that was not atypical. In Roslyn, which is a coal mining town, through the union, everyone who was employed had to donate a dollar to the new widow. And so at the turn of the century in Roslyn, a new widow might get $1,200. But of course, that was all she got as far as there was no life insurance.
They never buried anyone here?
They did not bury. There was no cemetery here, which is typical of Forest Service property. Mm-hmm. And in other communities that were company owned, to be very honest, I think it was because the company wasn't willing to dedicate land to a non-productive source or use. The company also released people for an hour or so to teach in the school periodically. There were mothers who helped in school, but there were also fathers who were released to teach in the school. What is more typical of normal towns is that the company here did not house the teachers at its expense. Mm. Often in a company town, you would see that there was a company house made available for a teacher at no charge, but that did not happen here. The first teacher lived in the staff house, and then he quit after a year, and Mrs. Field and another woman were hired, and there's some question as to whether they were hired before their husbands were hired, but it was a package deal. The company wanted to hire wives of people who had already secured housing. Mm-hmm. So Mrs. Field's husband ran he was the crane operator down at Lucerne, and they had a house in Winston. And Beth Bowie, who was here for several years, I think they lived in Winston, and then Mrs. Wilbur lived in the Circle, and there were other people who taught over the years, but the company did not provide housing for the teachers. One thing that was characteristic of company towns that existed here was company money script. If you've been to the museum, you have seen the little discs that the company called tin, and they were available in 50-cent denominations. That was different from other towns where they were usually paper coupon books and they had differing values, but here it was only 50 cents. And some people have said, well, that's probably why almost everything here costs 50 cents. For example, bus fare to Lucerne was 50 cents. What was interesting is you could use tin, as they called it, here and even in Chelan in many stores. But here you could use it for anything except the slot machines. Mm-hmm. And they had real coins for the slot machines. It was issued in the grocery store after it opened, which the grocer thought was absolutely wonderful because people went in to get their tin, and of course they usually spent tin on the way out. There was lots of wholesome recreation here. The sports I've talked about, a lot of people hiked. There was skiing. There was fishing. There was snowballing. They sledded down the road on moonlit nights. They had cribbage groups. Apparently during the war, they played cribbage in one house, and the next night they moved to somebody else's house. And people have said that kids learned to play cribbage as soon as they went to school and could count. Lots of potluck suppers. When kids came home at Christmas, they had the high school kids and the college kids would play basketball versus the older guys. So they had these challenged matches. They had lots of dances, but you couldn't go to a dance. You could not be on the dance floor if you weren't 16. And so that balcony that we have in the rec hall, that sometimes the kids were up there washing. And as Linda Jensen said, for the formal dances, most of the bigger kids were babysitting because it was a lucrative way to generate income. What I found real interesting is the dances were primarily for the family people, married couples. And I said, I don't understand. There were all these single men. And somebody said that there was no place for a date to stay. Obviously, the guys couldn't bring in their date and have her stay in the bunkhouse. And unless a family volunteered to put up somebody on their fold-out couch, there was no place for a woman to stay. Mm-hmm. So it became the dances, the informal dances were really an affair for the couples. By contrast, the women, the young women who came here, the daughters of the mining managers, especially the people who lived in the Circle, will even today laugh about how they kept track of the college students who came in to work. There were a lot of guys who came from Eastern colleges because they were sons of Howe Sound executives, not Holden executives, but the parent company executives, and they apparently were getting shipped out here for a summer in the real world. And they tended to eat together, and so if you were working in the dining hall, you could keep your eye on them. And one woman said she worked in the post office because it was a great place to keep track of all the guys as they arrived. And of course, they had to come in and collect their mail from the post office. As far as recreation, there was some recreation that was less wholesome. There were the slot machines until gambling was not only outlawed, but the outlawing was really enforced. I think there was a period where it wasn't quite legal, but it wasn't really enforced, and finally they started enforcing it, and they pulled them out. I understand there were nonstop card games, that there were people who got off their shift, played, went, you know, ate, slept, went to work, came back, and the card game was still going. And I have been told there were people who gambled away everything they made when they were here. There was a lot of homebrew. Nigel Adams, again, one of his stories was that your initiation as a teenager was that you had to steal so many pints of your father's home brew and share with your friends. And he also claimed that the Episcopal priest came up the lake, and after he'd done services in the rec hall, he would sit in the Adams's basement and have home brew with the miners who didn't care to go to church and sit and talk philosophy or whatever they wanted to talk. There was also a brothel that was 3 miles up lake. There's a sign in the rec hall that says Edgemont. It was a little directional sign. And Edgemont Lodge was a brothel. It was owned by a man named O.B. Brown, who had a music store in Wenatchee. And what someone told me was it was run by his wayward son. Apparently he decided this was a way to generate revenue. Some people said they thought that it was set up when they started construction of the mine, because they had all these construction workers. And some people said that it only operated on paydays and other special days. And one woman did tell me she remembered being at Lucerne and watching the boat go up lake, and there were women whose attire was not typical of the family women who were on the bow of the boat, and then it was a flag stop 3 miles up. And you go down so far on the road, and then there is a trail to the site of Edgemont. The building burned, and it is actually owned by a man who is in his 80s. One of the things that happened when I was researching the book was I was invited to be on a Chelan station, radio station's call-in show, and I said there were a couple of questions I was trying to resolve, and one was Edgemont. And two people called in. One was the man who owns the site today, and the other was a woman who had worked at Meadow Creek Lodge across the lake in the 1920s. And she thinks that's when it was started, because there was so much construction up lake in general. So disadvantages, when I talked to people, I said, what were the disadvantages? Even the people who liked it said you were extremely isolated. You were distant from your families. Some people lived here 3 or 4 years and never had a visit from families. There were people who lived here and didn't go out except every 3 or 4 years. And not only the logistics of getting in and out limited how often you would make that trip, but then financially it was a burden, especially for people who had lots of kids. People said it was very confining, especially in the winter. The houses were fairly small. The houses were very dark. And as I said, there was lots of activity at night, but there was very little activity during the day, especially for women who were inside with small children. The storekeeper said the women would put their children on the sleds and pull them to the grocery store just to see what was happening. Pick up their mail and just to get out of the house. There was another thing, and that is that many people perceived a rigid class structure, especially Winston versus the Circle. Many families didn't associate with the single miners, which was very typical of other company towns or towns similar to this, in the timber and the mining industry. A lot of the single people were transient. Some people have told me that this was perceived as a very safe place for guys who maybe had run into trouble with the law. They could get up here and work for a few years, and nobody really bothered them or caught on to where they were. Bill Phillips said that when he was carrying the paper, you never went into a bunkhouse. You delivered papers to the door, but you never knocked on a door without your father being with you. And so when you went to collect, you had your father with you. And the kids were not allowed in the bunkhouses otherwise. But the people, especially the people who were management children, said that they felt they were stigmatized as the boss's kids, and they were not always invited to Winston for the same games. And some of the women complained about having to make command performances at the tees being run by the wives of management people. And especially in the early years when these wives and mining engineers had to come down from Honeymoon Heights all dressed up. So you came down this dusty trail and then had to show up at a silver tee. They found that less than pleasant. Now, if you went on Linda Jensen's walk yesterday, you know that there are two myths which have been perpetuated here by some of the people who were involved early on when Holden Village was established, and they were particularly offensive to the people who lived here. One is that there was a liquor store. There was a rumor, and it's perpetuated in a book that's being sold in the bookstore, that there was a liquor store here, and that is not true. I had the good fortune to work with this woman in the our state archives, who went through the Liquor Control Board archives, and there was never a packaged liquor store up Lake. The last packaged liquor store was in Chelan. So despite what people say, well, we found all these Liquor Control Board receipts. And the only thing that we have ever been able to figure out is that when salvage crews came in after the mine closed to take out this machinery, that they brought in liquor, the company brought in liquor, the salvage company, and resold it to the men who were working here. People did carry in liquor. There are stories about people who would go out on their Christmas shopping trips, and they would return suitcases full of bottles so that they would have liquor cabinets full for their holiday parties. And there was homebrew. There is a story about somebody who kept a bottle in a snowbank as you went into Winston, so as you were getting ready to hike up the hill to your house, you could stop and have, you know, a little medicinal. And there's other stories like that, but there was no liquor store here. The other myth is that the mine closed overnight. People like to say, well, one day they said, we're done, be out tomorrow. And that did not happen. Harriet Wilbur had a great story about that. She said to me, how could that have happened? They could only barge up a few trucks at a time. And to move out, you had to have a truck barged up. You had to load your stuff on the truck and then have it barged back down. And so obviously moving took a long time. And the mine closure was announced in February 1957, and the mine actually closed in late June or the 1st of July. And prior to this, there had been a couple of years of warnings to new hires that this was not a long-term commitment. The government had quit supporting the price of copper, and there was some question about how much copper they were able to get out of the veins they were using. And so the company perceived at that time and warned people, new hires, that you couldn't count on this for long term. And in fact, when I was researching stuff on when Holden was actually established in the late 30s, there were several comments by the company that we have enough ore for 10 years. So it was never intended to be a long term commitment here. And many people found jobs, and they moved in the first half of 1957. There were people who were planning to move already, like Harriet Wilbur and her husband, moved because their child was getting ready to go to high school, and her husband found a job with Beeb Orchards in Chelan. But other families moved, and there is a clipping from a newspaper, either the Chelan or Wenatchee paper, that says the last day of school forever, and has a picture of the remaining students with the teachers on the steps of the school. And they talk about how many kids had already moved out between March and the close of school in June. So there was a very gradual The people who came here, the first Lutherans who came to work, said, but we went in houses and people hadn't taken their furniture, or they hadn't cleaned off the tables, and there were dishes left on the tables, there were toys left in the yard. And when you talk to people who lived here, they said, well, sure. Because at a certain point, you weren't going to carry everything out. You had to pay to freight everything out, especially if you were going past Chelan. And even people who left earlier for other jobs didn't take everything with them. The woman I mentioned, whose father was a carpenter, she remembered how her father had built a set of doll furniture for her sister and herself as a Christmas gift. And when they left at the beginning of World War II, they traded their house to someone for a car that was in Chelan and some cash. And she said, we left behind things like the doll furniture. It was given to a neighbor child. But people just didn't take things, especially when they were going long distances. And a lot of people were going on to other mining communities, and they were going to have a lot of travel. Probably the most amusing thing that I found in all the research I did was the fact that they kept coffins in the warehouses. I never had thought about that, and part of the reason it was so funny is it was reported to me in an extremely matter-of-fact fashion by the office manager's widow. It was just, well, that's the way it was. You know, you had to have a way to get people out, and they shipped them up and kept them in the warehouse, and when there was a need, that's how you left. So... mention when it came up close, or I can pass it around. This is from 1944. This is when a group of GIs came up here to visit, and it resulted in a feature in the Spokesman Review, the full-page feature, about what a great place Holden was to visit. And some of the long-term employees are pictured in this. But that's an idea. This was not atypical. The community often hosted servicemen during the war from the different bases. And typically there was a dance, and there was a baseball game as part of the event. But it was kind of interesting to me that it got a whole page in the Spokesman Review. So that's what I have prepared. Do you have questions that I can answer?
Yeah, what about medical? Do they have a doctor and nurse here? And what about women that were expecting their babies? Would they go into Wenatchee or Chelan or what?
Agape was the, I think it was a 4-bed hospital.
Mm-hmm.
It had an apartment for the doctor and his wife, who was often the nurse, and it also had separate nurses' quarters, and we thought that the nurse was a single woman, which
mm-hmm.
sometimes occurred. Mona Getty grew up at Lucerne, and her father ran the resort there. She was for a time the nurse here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then they had a dental chair. And there's
mm.
a picture in the book of dentists. They had the same dentist almost the entire 20 years. He came up once a month and worked on people. There were very few babies born here. The company discouraged it. But there were a few women who took natural childbirth preparation from doctor and nurse and then delivered here. But most women went out. They either sat at Campbell's Lodge waiting to deliver in the hospital in Chelan, or they went out and they stayed with relatives.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of association or anything about the people that live here, but that are still around? I mean, are they, you know what I mean, informally
yeah.
or
they
otherwise?
Get together every other September. I came last September when they got together, and this Holden Minor goes to more than 300 people, and anybody who wants to be on the mailing list gets on the mailing list, and then you get notified of the reunions, and then when you come, you say you're coming for the reunion, and they bumped them all together. It was really fun last year because I was alone, but I could hear, you know, all this laughter down the hall. These people who had gone to school with each other in the late 40s and early 50s were partying. Middle-aged way, they were partying. Tell stories.
They do the reunions here at Holden?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of partying, why you mentioned the two myths that were sort of debunked
mm-hmm.
there. Why would the suggestion, whether true or false, that there was a may have been a liquor store here, be offensive to you?
Because this was, as Linda Jensen has emphasized, this was a real family community, and as I said, it was probably one of the best of the mining communities. And I think there's a feeling that the first Lutherans tried to portray it as a rough and ready community, that there was a lot of drinking and gambling and carousing. And I think the people who come back tend to have been part of families, and I think they are offended by the effort to portray it that way. And I think that's the same reason they're offended by the suggestion that it was an overnight closure, because this was, in many ways, a very supportive company, and some of the things that the companies provided were way above what you see provided in other companies. And I think they resent the implication that the company was not benevolent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly the company was paternalistic. If you were coming in for a job, probably, especially a professional or management position, your wife was interviewed with you. But the reality, and that was a typical other places. Some of us go to church with Matt Smith, whose father taught with somebody who taught at Grisdale, which is a Simpson timber logging camp in the Olympic Range. And that was the situation where the wives were interviewed. And it was because you were coming into a community of 400 or 600 people, and they just wanted to make sure you knew what you were getting into.
There was never a calamity in any of the mines, right?
There was never anything like a tunnel collapse. No, there were accidents, and there were deaths, but no, there was never any accident, any major disaster. And that's something Linda Jensen has emphasized. The company had a very good track record as far as safety. I think that's probably because it was later.
Were there written accounts of what life was like for the single miners living in these bunk houses and working in the mine?
What was life like?
Yeah, are there descriptions of that?
There isn't a lot written up because a lot of those people either didn't stay single. Some of them lived a year or two in the bunkhouses and they married and brought a family, brought a wife in and then became part of the family community. Some of the pictures that Larry Penberthy graduated from what was in the College of Puget Sound in Tacoma, and he, in the end of the Depression, did not have the money to come up with, so he hiked in from Darrington and worked here for about a year and a half prior to going on to something else. And he took pictures the whole time he was here, and there's lots of pictures, like the basketball team. And you look at those, and you know those were really young guys. So he probably did a good job of documenting some of the things they did. And I know that a lot of them did things like they were involved in sports or they hunted. I don't know if they had a glee club here or not, but when you read the minor, which always has the little notes on, you remember so-and-so, and it'll say, well, so-and-so who lived here for a year before he went on to Nye, Montana or something, and a lot of them came, say, at the end of college, or they came while they were earning money for college, but some of them came, like John Bly came as a single man, lived in the bunkhouse, and then married his college sweetheart, and they lived at Honeymoon Heights, and then they lived, I think they lived in Winston, and then they lived here in the Circle. So a lot of the people who, the men who came here single, that they were single a very short time for their period here. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea, any concept of what the percentages would have been, single guys versus married people?
Oh, it was huge, because you look at those lodges. Every one of those dorm rooms had two guys in it. And originally, there were accommodations for about 50 people in the Circle between the chalets, and where the office is now for registration was the apartment for the hotel steward and his family. And then there was Agape, where the doctor lived. But that was the original housing for families, and everything else was single guys.
So it would have been hundreds. Hundreds of guys, single guys, and how many families then at a given time?
Well, in the beginning, you probably had about 15 families before Winston was born. Winston was built, pardon me. And that was part of the reason for Honeymoon Heights, because the company anticipated, you know, we remember that the company was setting this up when the Depression was still fairly severe, and they anticipated that men would come in, would leave their families behind and live in the dorms, or that the men would come in would be single. But by the time it actually opened, the Depression eased enough that men were not willing to do that long term. I mean, there were people like Linda Jensen's father who came here short term without their families. But long-term, that wasn't the solution. That's how Winston came to be, and it's also how Honeymoon Heights developed, because when they brought in all these engineers, they were all getting out of college, and they all wanted to get married. So they had to provide housing for them.
Are there any examples, you talk about how, you know, life was cheap here. I mean, you could make pretty decent money, mm-hmm. not have to spend a lot, and if you focus, you get your little grub steak. Mm-hmm. Are there any examples of folks that were here that left and went on to sort of bigger and better things, you know, found taking that grub stake and founding a whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Now, Bill Phillips's family left a year or so before the mine closed, and they bought an orchard in Chelan, and that remains in his family. And that's probably the best example I can think of. There were people who came at, like, the Whitbers family, the blinded miner, they left when their daughter went to high school, and they went down lake, and he established some sort of little business. I want to say woodworking, but I'm not sure. I mean, it wasn't like they went on to invent things. Larry Penberthy went on, and he was one of the founders of, I think it's Mountain Research, and he was involved in several companies in the Seattle area and actually ran for Congress at one point. So he was fairly prominent in certain circles. Some of the people were fired. Jack Curzon, who was the general mine superintendent, lived in the big house. He was fired when things started to wind down here. And there are people who feel that maybe he was made the scapegoat for the mine not being as productive. But the reality was that the veins were running out. And and they went to Spokane, and he had other jobs, but probably nothing as prominent as he had been here. And the other thing you have to remember is when the people left here, most of them were middle-aged. The people who came and stayed, they came at 22 or 25, and 20 years later, they were leaving with grown and children, and with the time when it was hard for middle-aged men to make a change. And it was also a time when there were fewer mining opportunities. So,
can you speak to the remaining environmental issues that resulted from the mine? I know a lot of the streams is pretty polluted and still affecting this creek here.
You know probably as much as I do. I was here when the Forest Service spoke in September on the remediation efforts. I will tell you that the remediation is being paid for by the event. Whoever owns the mining patents, that Howe Sound merged, and then there were subsequent mergers, but they have been able to identify the responsible parties for that, and so it is being paid for by the owner of the mining patents. But I have to tell you, very honestly, I find that very complicated, and you would be better off speaking either to Linda Jensen, who is going to be working from Rick Dunning's notes, and there, I think, is a lot of information in the museum that has come from the Environmental Protection Agency and the Forest Service. I believe the Forest Service is the lead agency. And also, if you want to go and type into Google, you can get all sorts of stuff. There's an amazing amount of information that's been filed on the internet now regarding the cleanup efforts here.
The Forest Service and NORDE actually has a very extensive website set up on that remedial project.
That's right. For those of you who haven't met her, this is Linda Cole Jensen, who grew up here in the 1950s. And we'll be doing a slideshow later in the week and also doing a mine hike today, too.
Today, the history of mine. The one that Rudy Evans started and worked on any of those, but Rick's hiking.
Did you do any research on other settlement on Lake Chelan besides here, like, say, Meadow Creek or Stephen?
No, the other settlement that I looked at was Bede. It was Bede, Washington. It was owned by the people who established Bede Orchards. And part of the reason I was interested in that is because if you go up a certain road, it still says the Bede Bridge, and that was a community that was accessible only by privately owned bridge or by boat. They actually had their mail delivered by boat for years.
And where is that? Where's Bede?
I can't tell you exactly where it is. It's not too far from here.
But it's on the lake.
It's either on the lake or on the river.
The bridge is on the river. When I lived at Shiloh Falls, it was called Bebe. Is that the same?
It's the same thing. I'm mispronouncing it then.
And which is actually where the railroad stop was that the ore bucket was going to. They didn't have place like about half a mile from Shiloh Falls or something.
And I think that was it, that the mail came in on the railroad, and they threw the mail by it off, and somebody from the orchards came and picked it up and took it. Either in a boat or across the bridge.
It would be down in the area where the bridge is across the river now, for 597.
It's kind of an interesting family because it's an East Coast family, and they had a son who was, I guess you would say, quite the playboy, and he had a private rail car in which he tramped the country, and he wrote several books, but that was probably in the first half, about the 1900s, Lucius Bebe. Well, I can answer any questions you have, or you can go to lunch. Thank you for coming.